This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
I'm Madeline Morris. I'm the host of the Question Time series here at the Wheeler Centre. We do these once every month. We talk about issues that are in the news, issues that people are talking about, and we arrange a panel of people who are experts in the field, and we hand it over to you to ask them all the questions that you want. And tonight we're talking about infertility or fertility, either side of the coin, because baby making is a very big business in Australia. One in six couples is infertile. Now, in the old days, there would have been one option or two options available to them. One is they don't have children. The other one is that they have an adopted baby. Now, of course, there are so many other potential options that they can go down. There's a surrogacy, there's donors, and there's just good old-fashioned IVF, which has been with us for more than 30 years now, pioneered here in Melbourne. So it's a huge business in terms of the number of people that access assisted reproductive technology. It's also a very big monetary business in Australia. So an IVF cycle can cost you $12,000 at some of the top flight clinics. Every year, the Australian government spends $250 million in Medicare rebates for assisted reproduction. There are no caps on the number of IVF cycles you can go through. I interviewed a doctor once in my day job, which is as a reporter for 7:30, who told me once that he had done 26 cycles for one woman with no success. And that, you know, who knows what the Australian taxpayer spent on that. So governments are really, I think it's pretty much universally agreed, struggling to keep pace with the facts on the ground in terms of assisted reproduction, particularly in the surrogacy area. And in some cases, the ethics are actually being decided by practitioners, some of whom work for what are now very big companies, assisted reproduction companies, some of which are publicly listed. And we talk a lot about the rights of a couple to have a family. One thing that we don't talk about is the rights of a child who is conceived through some sort of assisted reproduction, particularly in the donor and surrogate communities. So whether we should be talking about that is something that you might like to tackle tonight as well. So this is your opportunity to speak to the experts who we have here, all of whom have very personal experience in assisted reproduction. And myself as well, I have a baby who is 9 months old, and she... I've just got newly diagnosed asthma, and I'm just not used to speaking with it. It's taking me a while to get used to. My own baby is 9 months old, and she's an IVF baby. We had a couple of miscarriages, and in the end just decided to throw some money and science at the problem, and fortunately for us, after two cycles, we welcomed our beautiful Nina 9 months ago. The panel all have very personal experiences. They're all very happy to take personal questions. So I'll introduce them to you, and then we can get started with some questions, just a few questions to introduce them to you, and then you just need to ask your own, just put up your hands and our two ushers will come to you, and they'll signal to me when they've got a question. So we'll start over on the end. So this is Chloe Allworthy, and Chloe's a high school teacher. And she discovered at the age of seven, conceived through a donor sperm, and she went on a hunt to find her donor, mm-hmm. and finally managed to track him down after quite a long journey. She's currently doing a master's in social work, and after she completes that, she hopes to work with people who are looking for their donors. Julia Lee is a filmmaker and a novelist, and her memoir Avalanche tells of her ultimately unsuccessful series of IVF treatments and the physical and the emotional toll that it took. Her novels and Avalanche are available tonight for sale at the back of the room. Robert Reith is the president of Surrogacy Australia, which is the peak body for consumers involved in surrogacy. And earlier this year, Robert and his wife welcomed a daughter via their sister-in-law surrogate. So our babies must be about the same age.
January 7.
Yeah, I was December 30. Yeah, You having troubles teething as well? We can take this offline. It's like a complete nightmare in my life at the moment. I've got a baby who's totally addicted to baby Panadol. And community educator at VARTA, which is the Victorian Assisted Reproductive Treatment Authority. She's a social worker by profession, and she provides support to families and children who were conceived through a donor process. And she formerly worked in adoption, and she also has personal experience of assisted reproduction, having had two IVF babies.
Two daughters,
a little bit older than Robert's and mine.
A lot older, 25 and almost 23.
Oh, wow. So that might be something that we can talk about. I'm just going to move this slightly closer to you as well, Kathy, because it'd be interesting to get your take on the differences in the IVF community and treatment and that whole space 20 years ago as opposed to now. I'd be very interested to hear that.
Absolutely.
But Chloe, why don't we start with you and sort of your journey, just to let people know what you experienced.
Sure. Hi, everyone. Thank you for having us here, and thanks for coming along, because it's great to know that you're all interested in this topic. So I'm donor conceived, and as Madeline mentioned, I found out when I was about 7 years old, and at the time I didn't really think much of it. As a child, when you're told something like that, I guess at that age I didn't think too much more into it until I was I was about 18 when I started to really think about it. Began looking for my donor at that age. I'm now 25 and have found my donor, and we have a great connection, but it was a very difficult road in finding him, and also the legislation at the time made that a little bit more difficult. So we're very lucky here in Victoria now that the legislation has recently changed in March to allow all donor-conceived people in Victoria the rights to identifying information on their donors.
Which was controversial at the time, because at the time that your dad... at the time that your donor... donated.
Yes, he was anonymous.
He was anonymous,
yeah,
and he presumably
correct.
Had the expectation that he was going to remain anonymous?
Yes, that's correct. So at the time when my donor donated, they actually had no choice, though, to be anything but anonymous. So there was no other box to tick, such as open to contact. So my donor actually called the clinic in 1994, I think, so a few years after I was born, and my 11 siblings through the donation. And the clinic told him that there were no successful pregnancies. So all this time he didn't know I existed. So that was quite horrible for him.
So how was that moment, just to skip through when you first called him and said hi?
Yeah, it was amazing. And we were both very emotional, obviously, and he was... very excited, because he said that he'd always wanted more children. He'd always dreamed of having more children, and his dreams had now come true. So it was really lovely.
We go along, we might get a little bit into, Chloe, why you really wanted and felt that you needed to make that connection with your donor, and sort of how that's worked out with your parents too.
Yeah.
So Julia, Avalanche is your memoir, effectively, of, you know, the... I can only describe it as difficult experiences that you had on IVF. Tell us what happened.
Okay, so I did IVF. I'll tell you exactly what I did for those of you who have a special interest in this subject. I did 2 IUI and 6 egg collections, followed by 5 subsequent transfers. I was unsuccessful. And I actually, even though... my journey was unsuccessful, I also was surprised at the response to my book by women who didn't end up having a child after a long road of treatment. They also had a very difficult journey, and often they find that they can't talk about it because, in a way, because they ended up with a child, it might seem churlish to complain. I suppose what I would really like to talk about tonight is... not so much, although I'm very happy to talk about it, my own the intense emotional journey, and physical journey, etc., that I went through, this sort of magical thinking, this grip of the strong desire for the child to be. But I also really love it if we could talk about the magical thinking that pervades the world that the women find themselves in. And I'd love one of my doctors, for example.
Well, why don't you tell us about that now? Because this is something that's very, very dear to your heart. And I think is something that's often missed when people talk about IVF. It's not just about, you know, the desire of a couple for a child. It's the hugely pressurized, commercialized environment that families find themselves in.
And I'm not sure how many of you saw the show that was on Four Corners called The Baby Business, but there was a great scene in it where Professor Michael Chapman, former president of the Fertility Society of Australia, a very senior figure, was being pressed about clinics offering patients add-on treatments that were essentially unsupported by good evidence, right? And he said, and I'll quote it to be absolutely fair to him, he said, if I'm not doing any harm and I may do good, and I don't know whether I'm doing good or not, but if I do no harm, I feel comfortable in prescribing a treatment if the patient thinks that that's going to be of assistance to them. And I thought that was great because, first of all, you know, it's up to the patient what the patient thinks is going to be of assistance to them, right? Who's the medical expert here? But what I really thought was very telling about this comment was this kidding yourself that you're doing no harm. And, for example, I was offered a treatment which is called the natural killer cell protocol. Now, that involves suppressing your immune system for 3 months and during that time taking a blood thinner. Now, I consider that harmful. And I also just want to point out that even in just these drugs that you have to inject yourself with over and over and over, I took something called gonal F. It's a synthetic hormone. And doctors are obliged to... they often may mention in passing something called ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome. Now, this is harmful in that it can potentially kill you. It can potentially be fatal. But there are more common side effects of gonal F, and I'll just run through them because these are real harms. Although you're not guaranteed to get them, but this is why it's, you know, complicated. But common side effects: headache, ovarian cysts, nausea, upper respiratory tract infections, nostalgia, abdominal pain, diarrhea, vomiting, dizziness, sinus infections, vaginal bleeding, fatigue, back pain, and mood swings. In addition, serious pulmonary conditions have been reported, such as acute respiratory distress syndrome. Rare cases involving blood clots have resulted in death. So I just sort of feel that there's a lot of magical thinking on the doctor's side of things that they're doing no harm.
Robert, I mean, you also went through an heroic number of IVF.
I didn't. my wife did.
But you were there. Your wife's the one sticking the needles in. But yeah. But you know, you have to live through the trauma and the difficulty of all of that. Tell us about your own journey.
Yeah. So we went. We stopped counting after about 20 actual IVF retrievals. We went through multiple family members, my wife's sister, friend, and we finally found a donor and. We were able to conceive, and my sister-in-law was our surrogate. So, but the trip to surrogacy, you know, is at this stage it's a last resort, and in my I don't think it should be left to the very you're basically at the end of your tether, your relationship, you're strained, you're financially strained. It should be a much more there should be sooner intervention in terms of possible options rather than just continuing more and more cycles.
But in Australia, I mean, surrogacy is still really difficult. It's difficult to find a surrogate. It's difficult to negotiate everything. I mean, and there are so few legal protections for both intended parents and the surrogate.
Yeah, so in across Australia, it's illegal to pay anyone. New South Wales, it's a little bit easier in terms of compensation, in terms of, you know, paying for parking and things like that. But in Victoria, it's very strict. There are no avenues, a formal legal avenues to advertise to that you need a surrogate, or in fact, if you want to be a surrogate, there's no ways to actually find intending parents.
Mm. It's kind of like a speakeasy situation, isn't it? There are these forums where everyone's kind of, hi.
But the Facebook and online forums are fantastic. There's this huge community of surrogates out there who and incredible women who just want to help other people start their families. But they're just not supported at this stage by government and regulation.
Mm. And I've actually done a story with a woman who was a surrogate, and it was a total disaster for her psychologically, physically, and financially. It was a complete disaster, and because the laws haven't kept pace with the reality and she wasn't given sufficient protection and the couple weren't given sufficient protection, it's just the great tragedy of her life.
Well, yeah, it's hard to... You can't have a contract. I mean, it's not binding at all.
Yep.
There are no... there's no templates, there's no support, and people are looking for that. You know, they're at the end of the road and they're at a fragile state, to say the best of things.
Mm.
There are some movement from government, both federal and state, here in Victoria at least, and there's a recognition that the framework needs improving. So we've had multiple conversations with health ministers, attorney generals, both state and federal, and they've acknowledged the problem. Now, commercial surrogacy is probably a step too far at this stage. In Australia, we don't advocate for commercial surrogacy. Compensation, we think, is fair.
You know, can you explain to me what is the difference between compensation and a fee?
Well, for example, in Victoria, we couldn't... my sister-in-law, so my brother's wife was our surrogate, we couldn't officially pay for a cleaner to clean her house. She's got 5 kids of her own. And we couldn't pay for a taxi for her to go to the... So those types of things. Now, compensation in my world could be like a paid parental sort of minimum wage type of thing. Why should, in the whole process, the only people not to get any money, the counsellors, the IVF doctors, the lawyers, we've just been through the process, it's about $8,000 just for us to be the parents on our daughter's birth certificate, get paid, when the person arguably doing all the heavy lifting, literally and physically, isn't paid, sent, we can't buy groceries for.
Mm. And those are the sorts of things that need to be nutted out and discussed at an Australia-wide level, not necessarily at a state level, which is currently how they're being produced.
Yeah, and lots of people don't know anything about surrogacy.
Yeah.
Most politicians don't know anything. A lot of them that I've met with personally, you know, still unsure if it's legal or not.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, there's this huge dearth of information.
And the baby gammy case did not help.
No, that yeah. was pretty bad for everyone.
Okay, yeah, Kathy, tell us a little about I mean, your own experiences. You have 2 babies via IVF, yep. grown-up kids now.
Yep.
But what is it that you do? What does VARTA do for those people who don't know? And what are you doing at VARTA?
So VARTA is the statutory body that... it's called the Victorian Assisted Reproductive Treatment Authority, and it's the governing body over assisted reproductive treatment, and it has a wide range of functions. The particular role that I have at VARTA is I am the senior counsellor for assisting donor-conceived people, donors, parents, who would like to connect with the people that they are genetically related to through making an application to the donor registers. So VARTA manages the donor registers. And so my role, and there's... the manager of the registers and 2 other counsellors, we actually assist with that process under the legislation and help people prepare for connecting with people that they are genetically related to but potentially have been strangers. So my experience has come from some work that I've done in adoption reunion as well.
Mm.
And, of course, I have my own personal experience of infertility many years ago. So I guess I have that personal empathy as well for families who have undergone IVF treatment. I really I guess, had that personal experience of seeing it from all angles.
And in terms of donors, how is that fitting in the wider scheme of assisted reproduction? Is that on the up? Is there more and more need for donors?
Absolutely. The reality these days is that the largest number of people who utilise gamete donation, both sperm and eggs, but particularly sperm, single women, same-sex couples, and these are, families that people wouldn't have envisaged had these opportunities 15, 20 years ago. Yeah. So many of those families, obviously the children know from a very early age that their family have potentially used a donor, or they may not have a dad in the picture. So many of those families actually would choose to learn and gather more information about the donor if it's right for their family, and we can help them with that as well. That's the sort of counselling we offer. So we prepare people for that connection.
Sure. Julia?
So I was just going to say, jump in and say, so I'm not at all into commercialisation of surrogacy in any way, and nor for the world of donors, sperm and egg donors.
Yes. That would certainly be your Victorian position. Yeah.
Is that your from
and
your
that
experience?
Would be vast, yes. Yeah. I think that there are commercialising donation and surrogacy brings with it its own complications and risks. But in with Robert's point that there needs to be legislation around this that clearly outlines what reasonable expenses are, and so it's a complex area, and certainly I think in Victoria we would be within Australia, Victoria would have probably the most progressive laws in relation to donation, but surrogacy is still certainly that's not my particular Advaita, that's not my particular area of expertise, but certainly it's recognised as we get a lot of calls throughout, not just from Victorians but from Australians, about this, about surrogacy and the complexities.
Because there is no, as you were saying before to me off stage, there is no equivalent in other states, which seems like a real shame.
That's right. Yeah.
Vata, I mean. All right, so we've probably let the interactions run on a little bit too long, and we should certainly open up the floor to questions. So who would like to kick us off?
Hi there. One thing that I noticed the panel was talking about, or rather not talking about, is that of adoption. And I want to know why the panel have not really discussed it here tonight. Is it that is it the case that the process of adoption is even more harrowing than that of IVF? Or is it the case that perhaps the panel would rather or would want children that are their own flesh and blood?
Well, we don't have an expert on adoption, as you rightly point out here, or someone who's had experience of it, but I'm sure that it's something that some of you have considered.
To some extent. I think I haven't worked in adoption now for nearly 3 years, but I was working within adoption and watched a lot of change happening. Now, over the last 20, 30 years, adoption has changed significantly because of a number of reasons. Obviously, social reasons, in that there are not as many children that are legally available for adoption, because, 40, 50 years ago, it was a different place for women who may have had a child back then out of wedlock. Well, of course, this is just not how Australia is these days. So in terms of local adoptions, it was very small numbers. In relation to, overseas adoption, and again, I'm only speaking from past experience, I'm no longer in that field, rapidly changing. And even in many of those overseas countries that had previously had significant numbers of children that could be placed overseas, even within many of those countries, they had moved forward in very much in trying to retain the care of their own children that needed care in terms of foster care and local adoption within those countries. So it was becoming increasingly clear to within the adoption field that things were changing. So many of the children that were requiring placement had significant health needs and so on. So, it was also a changing field. And yes, I think probably many parents would say that being assessed as being parents for adoption would be very harrowing. I think, IVF treatment is also very harrowing. So some people who may be coming to look at adopting a child may have also experienced a number of years of IVF treatment too, and would be significantly, still coping with all of that grief and loss. So there are very big issues for parents who, wanting to be prepared to be caring for a child with high need through adoption.
We got the papers and we were told you may, good luck, sort of. That's probably the way we felt about it.
Yes.
It wasn't, oh, well done, wait 12 months and here you go. And that was before we went down the surrogacy route. I think it's just nearly impossible now. We were 37 when we started looking at adoption. We thought, well, if we have to wait another 10 or 15 years...
Well,
we were told between 3 and 8, but,
wow.
They were sort of... I'm not sure what the numbers are, but I don't think it's in the hundreds. Like in a handful a year sort of thing.
And can you answer the second part of the question, which is about the desire to have your own flesh and blood, your own genetic material? How?
Yeah, why does anyone have their own children? I know it's easier for a lot of people. But in terms of course, I don't think you can hide away from the fact that people want to have their potentially genetically related children. I see adoption as being very different to surrogacy. I think they're entirely different, and the fact that adoption now is just on such low numbers it's becoming less and less relevant.
Did you look at that, Julia? Would you ever consider adopting, or was that just not something that came?
I didn't consider it at the beginning. And I guess I got caught up in the, I wanted to have my own child. Mm. I was a wreck by the end of it. I couldn't have embraced adoption. But frankly, for me in Australia, as a single woman of, how old was I at that time? Early 40s.
Mm.
No regular job or all this kind of stuff. Yeah, the numbers are crazy low. I think there's something like 6 in New South Wales a year. Is that wrong? It was like practically impossible here. So then there is the question of overseas adoption. I didn't go down that path, no.
Yeah.
It has its own. It is uniquely different to having a child that is genetically related and also bonded from... in utero and from birth. Mm. I think there are some parallels in relation to adoption and donor conception, some parallels.
I also think, of course, if in a fairy tale, a lovely wicker basket showed up with a baby on the doorstep, you would take the baby in, and of course you would love the baby. Do you know what I mean?
But, of course, it's not that simple, is it?
In other words, I don't think the quality of love is any different, ultimately.
Oh.
I think we all agree on that. That's just the...
Can I just mention, my donor has three of his own children, and he also adopted.
Wow.
So he adopted a child from Taiwan. So I found that out when I met him. So I think it took him 4 years to adopt her. So that
did you ever have
that
conversation with your parents about whether they considered adopting rather than having you? No.
No, I didn't. That would be an interesting question to ask them.
Yeah.
Have
you got brothers and sisters?
I've got one brother.
Yeah.
From your
parents.
Yeah.
One brother from your parents.
Different. Yeah. Different.
Let's talk about IVF. Well, let's go to the next question, because that's what we're here for. So who's got a question?
Hi, thanks for coming tonight. So my question is probably for the lady who works at Varta. Sorry, what was your name?
Kathy Anderson, yes.
Yeah, Kathy. So you said just before that in your opinion, the laws around donor legislation in Victoria are the most progressive in Australia. But my GP actually told me that if I wanted a known donor, I would actually have to go to Queensland, and that Queensland was the only state in Australia that allowed known donors.
See, that's very accurate information. Inaccurate information.
Oh, is it?
That's very inaccurate.
Oh, I apologise.
There's a difference between a known donor and... I guess it's not an anonymous donor.
Sorry, I think I need to use the term identifiable donor.
Well, all donors in Victoria will be identifiable by the child when a child turns 18. So people can select, if they have a donor, they can select to use a known donor themselves and go through the clinic with a known donor. But donors essentially are unknown in that, you know, people, if a family hasn't chosen a donor and that donor's agreed and gone down that path, they are an unknown donor. But the law in Victoria is when a child becomes 18, they are automatically entitled to that information about who their donor is.
And Robert, you have a...
Yeah, so donor. Just we applied online. There's a donor website that you go to, and believe it or not, our donor lived a street behind us, literally less than 100 metres. And we were talking to people from all over the world, basically. So that was really weird. So we didn't know it before then. Now, we had... she was born in January. My sister-in-law and my brother's names are on her birth certificate, and we had to go to the county court to get their name off and put our names on as her parents. And I was going to actually... on the birth certificate, there's no difference between anyone else's birth certificate, but the number is a little bit different. And I think that will just... there's a record as an addendum to
her. So if a child applied for their birth certificate at 18, they would be advised... There's an addendum that would advise them that there is more information about their birth available to them.
But just to be clear, your donor... I'll come back to you in a second. Your donor is completely identifiable. Your child will have the opportunity to know that
sperm
donor...
Sperm or egg donor, sorry.
Egg.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To know that donor, should she wish and should...
Yeah, absolutely. And you've got that donor has to sign the forms for the patient review panel in a surrogacy arrangement anyway. So, you know, you can do it, I promise.
Sounds like your GP is a bit out of date.
Well, I did actually call a couple of IVF clinics, obviously, regarding this. And Monash told me that only childhood photos were allowed to be viewed. I don't consider that to be an identifiable donor.
There's a donor profile. Parents under the legislation, once a child is born, if parents would like to potentially have contact with the donor or know more about the donor, they can apply under a central register application. Now, until a child turns 18, that donor has to give consent for his details to be released. But once a child's 18, they're automatically released if somebody applies for that information. So it's really about until the child turns 18, then a child would know who their donor is. So there's no anonymous donation through Victoria.
Varta's probably should be a little bit more specific. I suppose I'm referring to myself being able to view a picture, a photograph, and select a donor from a photograph.
Okay, so... I don't work for one of the clinics, but the clinics, there are a number of different clinics, probably they have their own rules and guidelines around donors and what information is provided to somebody who is choosing a donor.
My GP said that I would actually need to go to Queensland if I wanted to select
visually, I hear you. Yes, that may be accurate. Not all people want to select a donor visually, and I guess, you know, that would be another conversation about why you want to choose a donor visually?
I think that your best bet probably is to go to VARTA.
Yeah,
and VARTA are the people who regulate it and who will be able to give you as much detailed information as you would like. I'm going to move on to another question just because, you know...
We can speak about this after.
Yeah. Thank you, Kathy. Yes, please.
Yes, it was mentioned that there are more single women in the process and equally same-sex couples. Could you tell us if the system still tends to favour heterosexual reproduction and if things are skewed less in favour of people who are otherwise situated? And the question also relates to medical benefits.
I don't believe that IVF treatment is favoured to heterosexual couples at all. There is no... when people apply for or go to seek treatment, they would not be discriminated against their gender or being a single solo parent or marital status, not marital. I mean, in the past there was...
Although same-sex couples... if they need to, which they know, you're going to go.
Well, no, you go.
No, obviously, two guys, if they want to start a family, they're going to need a woman to be their surrogate. And the current Medicare laws say that if you want to undergo IVF treatment, but you need to use a surrogate, you won't fall under the Medicare legislation, so you don't get any rebate.
Yes.
Right, so it's a lot more expensive for two guys.
Absolutely. Technically, a lot of the clinics just work around it anyway, so it's a ridiculous law, but some don't.
Right, okay.
Because the same for us, because obviously my wife didn't have a uterus, so she wasn't going to be carrying a baby.
But in terms of choosing a donor, obviously solo people and same-sex couples will need a donor. They absolutely have access to that. But, of course, let me add here, I mean, in terms for... if we're going to look at IVF treatment, my experience of IVF treatment, I was very young when I undertook IVF treatment. I guess I was one of those fortunate people that, had a partner and I had my own... health reasons to want to decide to try for a family early. So it all worked out quite well for me. But I guess one of the things we are seeing more and more is that some of the IVF treatment is being sought or is age-related infertility. And I guess what I'm bringing this up is that perhaps as a society we could be doing better there was... for women, to have a career and all of those sorts of things, childbearing years are getting later and later. And I think there is a real, even for highly educated people, not everyone knows that actually by the time you reach 40, your chance of success, even with IVF treatment, of having a live birth is quite small.
And Julia,
is
that it's small? And were you made aware of that when you were going through the process? I think you started at 39, was it?
My story is kind of complicated. I first went to the clinic when I was 38. Then, for various reasons, I started treatment at 42. But the odds are extremely low in that age bracket, and. This is one reason why I really think it's pointless when we have ages.
Yep.
I think that's a real furphy. It's misleading in and of itself. And what I would advise patients seeing their doctors is to, when they're asking about success rates, etc., which is a very murky, complicated field that I'm a kind of de facto expert in now, unfortunately. But bottom line is, I would say get it in writing, because... what you'll have, most likely you'll have the doctor say, look, this is a very difficult, complicated field and it's very hard to say exactly and blah, 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 blah. And they'll try and wriggle out of giving you figures for their clinic, even figures for your exact age range, that kind of thing. And again, to point to magical thinking, this is an example that happened with me.
when I was 43 and I was transferring a 5-day blastocyst. So I asked my doctor, what are my chances of being pregnant? And my doctor said, I was 43, my doctor said, a day 5 blastocyst has about a 40% chance. I took that to mean I had about a 40% chance of being pregnant, right? Actually, that turned out to be a number for women of all ages. Okay, now I think that was highly inappropriate.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, certainly for women.
Right. I would try to get things in writing from your clinic. And I know it might seem pushy and you don't want to be perceived as difficult, etc., but I think it will force their hand to be as transparent with you as they possibly can be. And same goes for evidence, etc., about the treatments that supporting the interventionist treatments you're being offered.
There is increasing pressure, if I'm just add, Julia, on the clinics to try and be more transparent about their success rates.
So the ACCC, I think earlier this year or last year, had a bit of a crackdown on clinics and success rates. It's very difficult, though, because the Fertility Society of Australia does a review of success rates, and it says that there's a clinic that has 2% average for a particular age and another clinic that has a 40% average for a particular age, but they will never name the clinics.
It's
completely opaque. And there are some reasons why that is, you know, good, but then it just means that you're, as a consumer, you're effectively in the dark. Does anyone have a question for Chloe? She has a very, I feel like we're leaving her out there on the end, and she's got a very interesting experience. Yes, please.
Hi, yes, I'm wondering what the challenges and the opportunities have been of contacting your donor.
Mm, that's a good question. So my donor was found in South Australia. So I think at the time I just finished my teaching degree, and I was kind of trying to, I guess at the age of 22 when I found him, I was still thinking about my own identity and who I am as a person, and that was really difficult because I felt like I didn't share a lot in common with my parents, and although I loved them very much, I was very different to them. So I was trying to kind of connect the dots of where I got all these different traits from. So in contacting my donor and finding out that he was currently a teacher as well, was incredible. And the things that I loved, like music and the arts, I shared all of that with him. So it was just a really amazing moment for both myself and for him in meeting. And, definitely gave me a better sense of who I am and where I've come from.
And what about the challenges?
The challenges probably would be that not everyone that I know is probably okay with me looking for my donor or was okay with me looking for my donor.
Were your mum and dad okay with it?
Yes, they were, but it was difficult. I think it was a challenge for them, and I understand why, because, you know, as much as I love my parents, I understand that that would have been difficult for them to know that I was looking for my donor, and that didn't in any way reflect, you know, how much I loved them, because they're my parents at the end of the day. And this man just, you know, gave me the gift of life. So I wanted to thank him for that. So that was a challenge in, you know, having to sit my dad especially down and telling him that I was going to look for my donor was very difficult.
Yeah. And I mean, as we experience more as a society, children who are conceived through either sperm or egg donation. Mm. Is the desire to know a donor, would you say, I mean, I presume that you've been speaking to people within the donor-conceived community, is the desire to know your donor strong amongst donor-conceived children? How does that work?
Yeah, it's very different for everyone. I've met a lot of donor-conceived people that obviously want to know their donor and want to have contact with their donor. There's sometimes others that are actually just only interested in their siblings. And then there's some, like the brother that I grew up with, who have no interest whatsoever. So it's very different for every single donor-conceived person. And I think even if you do grow up in a loving household like I have, there's still maybe that want or desire to know more about it. It's a bit of a curiosity, and medical history as well.
Yeah, and yes, which is important, yeah. So, presumably it could be a bit of a disappointment as well.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah. I definitely, going into it, had the thought that my donor would not want contact, because I couldn't put myself through that, you know. I just didn't want to disappoint, be too disappointed. So I just thought, he doesn't want contact, so whatever outcome is going to be better than what I expect. So just in case.
Can I ask, do you have like monthly contact, yearly, or?
Yeah, so we have a little Facebook group that has all my siblings and my donor.
Oh, wow.
And so we kind of always sharing little, you know, if someone's going away. But every kind of 2 or 3 months we'll organise a trip together.
Ah, cool.
So the last one, I think there was about 20 of us. So we went hiking in the Grand
Canyon. He was a very successful donor.
Yes.
Very, very successful.
So we're looking for the rest. I'm hoping we can find all my brothers that I don't know. It would be amazing. Cool. We can go hiking together.
What was it like meeting those kids who are kind of you're genetically related to, but have grown up in such different environments?
Yeah, it was amazing. We all shared a love for music, myself and his children. So the first time I ever saw them was they actually sent me a USB in the mail, and I plugged into my computer and it was all of them sitting around the piano, and one of them on a guitar, and my donor, and they were all singing Oh Holy Night, and all harmonising beautifully, and I just started crying. It was so emotional, the first time I'd seen them, and they all introduced themselves on camera, and we just have a really great relationship, and it's just, honestly, it's been the highlight of my life so far. So,
and Chloe, can I ask you how? I think some of your connection didn't necessarily involve a lot of contact with Vada, but now this is the work Vada does.
Yeah.
Can you see the benefit that implications counselling to help people prepare for contact?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I definitely would encourage donor-conceived people, if they're deciding to look for their donors, or even parents if they have any difficulties, to contact Vada, because I think counselling is a really big part of you know, the process of understanding. It's a very complex, you know, topic, and it's a very complex issue. There's complex legislations and emotions. You know, it's a very difficult task. So
it's very emotive, isn't it?
Feelings. And it's very emotional. So I would definitely encourage anyone to go through counselling before, probably.
But one of the arguments that people make against same-sex marriage is that they believe that there needs to be someone of, you know, both genders in a relationship, and kids will grow up never knowing who their dad is or who their mum, you know, that sort of stuff. Do you have any sort of sympathy for people who say that you need to know where you come from and that needs to be guaranteed?
Oh, that's a difficult question. I do believe that every person should have the opportunity to know where they've come from.
And that happens in Victoria because of our donor laws.
The laws, yes. Yeah,
so it's fortunately we have that in Victoria now, but I think in other states it definitely needs to change, because I think everyone should have the opportunity to know where they've come from. I think it's really vital in your identity and understanding who you are.
Okay. All right, do we have another question?
Can I just jump in with a couple of quick things?
Sure, okay, and then we'll
really
go
quick. I just wanted to underline for you that this world of fertility treatment, assisted reproduction treatment, is absolutely big business. And Virtus, the main health... Virtus, which is one of the biggest IVF providers, they offer a high-performance share incentive scheme, which is worth about the equivalent of $500,000 bonus to doctors, who it's contingent if the doctor performs more than 400 cycles a year over 3 years. Okay, so just bear that in mind. But the other really, I also think this is kind of such a fascinating area, because what's coming down the line is so much genetic testing and ultimately genetic selection. And just a few days ago, it just finished yesterday, the Fertility Society of Australia held their annual conference.
And their keynote lecture on the opening day was titled Eugenics, Genetic Selection and Gene Editing. Is there a moral obligation to select the best child? Okay? And the person giving this talk, he would say yes. So I guess that those are two separate things, but I think you can see that they go together. Mm. This huge amounts of money is going into in this fertility world. You've got the clinics, you've got the genetic screening companies, you've got the health tech companies, the diagnostic solutions labs, you've got the biopharmaceutical manufacturers, the food and vitamin supplement manufacturers, the pharmacists, the surrogacy and donor organisations, the lab equipment suppliers, the lawyers, the insurers, the cryobankers and cryoshippers, the marketing people, the big data analysts, the specialist software providers, the joint venture partners who are going to help you grow your business. They're all over here. And here you've got the patients. So it's a complex world we're entering, a very big business. And with the advent of CRISPR and the ease of genetic editing, a lot of stuff is going to be happening in fertility clinics. And I think we should really open our eyes, and I think we absolutely urgently need to have a national organisation that has teeth, that's not just a paper tiger, that can, you know, centralise and regulate all this kind of stuff. I mean, there's no central register at the moment for stats about IVF, for following up. What's the short and long-term consequences of all these IVF? Is it going to be an epidemic of ovarian cancer in 20 years? Who knows?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I probably would add to that, though, Julia, that there is, whilst I hear what you're saying, I think there is a lot of work being done to, and I was at that conference for some of that time, to look at the challenges of the corporatisation of IVF. And, you know, there was a lot of work also being done at that conference about enabling to get back to being evidence-based, patient-focused. Those things, though...
Yeah, good, but you know what? Equity hates regulation. I mean, this is what I think is what should happen tomorrow at Virtus. I think that the doctors should call a meeting. I think they should not have their management there. And I think they should say, we vote that we do not want this high-performer incentive scheme. We vote to reclaim our integrity. And we reject that incentive scheme. That's what I think should happen.
That certainly gives us a lot of food for thought. The idea that you can get a bonus for... the more cycles that you do, I think there's a lot of questionable ethics about that.
Yep.
There was someone who we were about to go... Yes, please. We've only got 6 minutes left, sorry. Just, so we're going to try and cycle through a few more questions.
This is kind of for you, Julia, and I haven't read Avalanche, so I'm sorry if it's in there. I hope to read it. But I've worked as a counsellor in IVF, and one of the things I've really noticed people grapple with over so long is... And it kind of connects with what you're saying from the business sense, but certainly on... The emotional part of that is the cultural norm around if I really want this, and I think this is perpetuated in a whole lot of ways, if I really want this, I will keep going under any circumstances in any way. And it does feed into our whole cultural norm of, you know, if you'll fight hard, which is really challenging for people where their ethic is if you work hard for something, you get it.
Also, who's not going to fight hard for their child to be?
Absolutely. Mm. So I think... You know, and I'm curious when I'm working with people, the grappling with that and the existential crisis that brings on, but just the real grappling every cycle with that has such enormity to it that we never really talk about. Mm. And I'm curious with you or your experience, you know, how did you have the courage to stop? Because that's the other thing that is not talked about. Because I think that's what I see is courage to actually stop.
Mm. Yeah, excellent question. It was an extremely difficult decision to stop, one of the hardest I've made. I was 44, so I'd done all that stuff that I told you, 6 for 6 fails on egg collections. I said to my doctor, I'm 6 for 6 fails, you know. She said, well, why don't you give it one more go? At that point in time, I think the per treatment cycle success rate was something around 3%, right? In fact, it was my sister who essentially had to give me the tough love that I needed. And it was in the, it wasn't my doctor who told me to stop. It was my sister.
Did you feel relief once you'd made that decision, or what was your emotion?
Oh, it was such. Well, I can't simply say it was a relief.
No.
Yeah.
Complicated.
You know, absolutely. Yeah. It's a very complex question.
Yeah.
Thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it was a really good question because I think it is. I think. You know, you talked about that magical thinking of doctors, you know, that buying into, you know, when's enough is enough for somebody, and it's very
not
hard.
All doctors are, not all doctors, I don't want to, say all doctors are, you know,
but interestingly,
no integrity, but
there could be a financial, I mean, the government could actually do stuff like cutting off the Medicare rebate after a certain number of cycles, you know, that might be one.
That was lobbied against by the industry.
For what are also are very good reasons, but I mean, in other countries, that is the case. Is
that's
you know,
right.
We've got a couple more minutes. Another question, yeah.
Thanks. I know a lot of people are moving away from fertility clinics now and going to these matching websites, Robert, that you talked about earlier. And there's apps now where you just swipe left or right, you know, to. For a donor, if he looks good or he doesn't look good. It's a bit scary.
Is it that simple?
Yeah.
Right.
There's a new app called Just a Baby.
Wow.
And is this for just like so-called turkey-based at home, not going to
a
clinic?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So I'm just wondering, I know there's quite a lot of regulation around the number of donor-conceived children a donor can donate to, and there's a lot of regulation around all that sort of stuff. How's the law in terms of catching up with that whole other world that's going on out there where donors are just...
I think it's a really good question. It's a really good question.
Risky, dodgy things.
And I think that, you know, how do you capture that? Because if we get those calls at VADA, we do talk to people about the risks associated with not doing it through a clinic in that, you know, children born as a result of a donor, if it's not done through a clinic or it's not recorded anywhere, you know, those... And that child may never know who their donor is, or alternatively, the legislation around, well, you know, what if there's some difference, you know, the legislation actually protects donors and the parents, of course, from any legal situation if it's, you know, done through a clinic. So I think there are...
But just to cut to the chase on that, I mean, that's the ultimate sharing economy, right? You can't... And the government can't legislate against that.
That's right, no. Correct.
Can they?
No. People are still free to...
Yeah.
You know.
And there are great cases about...
Anyone heard of Tinder? Like,
yeah, that's right.
Traditional surrogacy goes
that's
back
right.
thousands of years.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
right.
This is not new in that sense.
That's right.
So basically, I mean, I didn't know about that. Yeah. That's really interesting.
Can I just say as well that with that, thinking about the implications on the child or, you know, now adult, of if you do choose someone, you know, outside of this that may be anonymous, just please think about, you know, that child and then, you know, the adult in the future and... the implications on them if they can't find out information on that person, because it can have a huge impact on, you know, your child and future adult when they're older and they do want to know.
And the number of potential donor siblings.
And the
reality of what that could be for a young person.
Absolutely. And there's the issue with dating as well. I mean, I have 15 brothers and sisters. Most of them are brothers and they possibly live in Melbourne and I don't know who they are. So they're all my age.
And there's that thing where people who are genetically related to each other are attracted to each other as well. And it's sort of go down a very different route.
Genetic sexual attraction.
It's a thing, right?
It is a thing.
Okay, yes, that's a risk for you. Maybe no Tinder for you.
No.
Yeah.
No, I've got my boyfriend DNA tested, just so you know.
All right, any more questions? Just, yes, one there, and then I think we'll have to wrap up, folks.
I just have a question. Now, last time I looked into this was a year ago, so my information might be out of date, but what do you think of the ethics of the fact that singles or couples undergoing assisted reproductive treatment need a police check to have a child, whereas the general population does not?
Chloe, do you want to start with this? Because everyone else has had a fairly good crack.
I was under the impression that everyone had to go through that. Am I wrong?
Everybody.
I think it's everyone has to go through a police check now.
For IVF treatment.
I had a police check.
Sorry, that's what I'm saying. I mean, like if...
In Victoria.
In Victoria.
Oh, yeah. I understand. Yep.
I don't think...
Sorry, I mean, like the general population of... I don't... You know, if I were to have sex with someone and get pregnant, I don't need a police check for that.
Absolutely.
But if you struggle to get pregnant and you need help medically, yep. do something.
What if you've got a police record, then what happens?
My understanding is that, and please, I don't work for a clinic, but my understanding around that is that there is a review process of that, but it would be a criminal record that related to children. So, but
serious,
yes.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks.
Right, and I think that probably. Look, that might be an issue for some people going through a clinic, but I certainly didn't mind having...
Yeah, I think if you've like got nothing to hide...
It's like, I'm doing 100 forms, yeah. why not make it 101?
Yeah, I hear you, and I think it's a really difficult one, and I think that I can understand why some people who... compared to somebody who can just have a child,
But it's also about protecting the child as well. And I think if that further protects them, I understand where you're coming from, but if that further protects the child,
and I guess it's taxpayers' money under Medicare, that's probably, I can't remember, I wasn't working with the clinics at that time that decision was made around that legislation, but it's subject to anybody seeking treatment, absolutely.
Okay. Look, guys, we are out of time. It's such a massive subject, really, and we've kind of gone all over the place this evening, but thank you very much for your questions, and I'll thank the panel, Chloe Allworthy, Julia Lee, Robert Reith, and Kathy Anderson.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing, and ideas from Melbourne, Australia, and the world.